Thanks for the opportunity to present this book here, which was our main preoccupation for the last 3 to 4 years. I think it's not only thick in volume with 1,056 pages, but also has a very dense content. The Wittgenstein Center has been set up 3 years ago as a collaborative effort between IASA, the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, where really there has been this tradition of population projections for the last decades. And then there is the Vienna Institute of Demography of the Austrian Academy of Sciences. This is a group of about 40 scientists, one of the leading groups on European comparative demography, and the University of Economics, where I'm also professor of social and economic statistics. So the Wittgenstein Grant, named after Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher, which is given once a year to a scientist in Austria, gave me the opportunity to bring these three groups together under one umbrella to create a critical mass of global significance. This volume really is the most comprehensive scientific assessment of what we know today about the drivers of fertility, mortality, migration, and also education in all countries of the world over the rest of the century. So this is more than 500 pages of this book, really try to summarize it. And this has three elements. The one is there are lead authors, 26 lead authors of the different background chapters that give a state-of-the-art review based on the whole literature in the field and also what they know. And then we have also 46 contributing authors, which are often leading experts in specific subjects that were contributing to these survey chapters. And then we had a major online survey, a questionnaire, where more than 550 international population experts contributed, and they had to assess in a peer review manner about 150 arguments that are directly relevant for future fertility, mortality, and migration trends. So we didn't ask the experts to just guess what would be the fertility, let's say, in Kenya in 2030. They asked to use their scientific knowledge, their evidence-based, science-based views on assessing the validity of arguments that then can be translated into alternative future trends of fertility and mortality. And then we have meetings on five continents of so-called meta-expert groups. These are distinguished experts that then were trying to synthesize the above sources of information and help us translate these into numerical assumptions for the population projections. So the second main contribution of this volume is the adding of education to age and sex as a main demographic dimension. As you know, up about to 1950, all population projections were made by just projecting total population size and assuming different rates of population growth. And then we started to stratify the population projections by age and sex, looking at the complete age distribution. And now just making another step in adding the education dimension to this. And it matters greatly for two reasons. One reason is that education is a very important source of observable population heterogeneity. Almost universally, more educated women have fewer children and lower child mortality, and more educated men and women live longer. So there's this very strong differentiation by level of education. But also, education is very interesting in themselves because it's a crucial determinant of individual empowerment, but also at the societal level as human capital, as a key driver of development, ranging from public health to economic growth to quality of institutions and even governance and democracy, and even adaptive capacity to environmental change. Now, what does it mean by age, sex, and level of education? You probably all have seen an age pyramid, which has women to the right, men to the left, sorted by age groups. So Singapore, in 1985, when I happened to visit the first time, I really was struck by meeting two different populations, so to say, in Singapore. A class divide that wasn't really a class divide, but it's an intergenerational divide. You have a modern, highly educated and wealthy young population and an uneducated and poor elderly population. And this is because Singapore has developed so recently. So if we step back to 1970, that's how far our reconstructions go, just the young people started to get educated and mostly sort of secondary education. But above the age of 40, almost all the women and most of the men had never been to school. And now the population of Singapore has changed not only in size and age structure, but but also in the level of education and how the more educated young ones move up the age pyramid. You see now the young ones are really highly educated. And by the way, between 80 and 2000, this is also when Singapore experienced this tremendous economic growth that we believe is directly associated with the improvement of the education of the younger cohorts. But still in 2000, you have uneducated elderly people there. It takes a while for them to leave the age pyramid. That's what we call also demographic metabolism, how societies change through intergenerational replacements, new generations coming in who are different and move up the age pyramid. 2010, this is today, have about the best educated young cohorts, so almost 80% with post-secondary education. Then some projections here, 2020, 2030. So you see, particularly in the East Asian cultural context, highly educated women have few children. That's why the age pyramid doesn't look like a pyramid anymore. And one of the key questions that we face in many European countries is whether the higher education of the young ones can compensate for their smaller numbers in terms of economic growth. Now, let's look at education differentials. That is the case of Kenya. In 2010, we have the empirical distribution of level of education, sort of fertility by level of education, as it's given by the DHS. It ranges from more than 6 children on average for the uneducated to 2.5 for the most highly educated groups. And of course, over time, this is an assumption. We assume that all groups experience some decline and there will be some convergence as we've seen it in most industrialized countries. The relative differences stay almost the same, but the absolute differences decline in fertility. Now, we've recently produced a review article in Science magazine where we try to sort of lay out the methodology and the basic rationale for integrating education and population. Assuming identical education-specific fertility trends, like just the pattern we've seen before, and then have two different education scenarios, and they make a huge difference. So this is the most pessimistic. It's the constant enrollment numbers, no new schools being built in a way, because population is still growing. Actually, the number of uneducated is increasing and there's very little improvement. And in that case, the world population increases already to 10 billion people by the middle of the century. Now, the other extreme we call the fast track scenario. This is that most countries in the world start following the Singaporean experience that we've just seen, very rapid education expansion, but assuming the same set of education-specific fertility rate. But simply because of the better education, the population is not only much better educated, but all the population growth will be less than 9 billion by the middle of the century. So there's more than 1 billion difference purely due to the effect of education. Why adding education to age and sex? What is the education effect, some may wonder. And I think, and we have a whole chapter in this book, that there are good reasons to assume what we call functional causality from education to health and fertility. We believe that in the social sciences, it is impossible to prove sort of strong causality that we are used to show in the natural sciences. But functional causality means that it is a very robust relationship that is safe to assume for the foreseeable future, and we have a good narrative how it works. So what is this narrative? Well, we go into brain research and go back to Eric Kandel, who got the Nobel Prize in 2000 for his work on memory and brain research. And when you're in a room with him, he usually often says that, well, now we reiterate this point for a second and a third time. Now it's permanently stored in your brains. And when you walk out this door, you're physiologically a different person than when you entered it. And in this sense, every learning experience changes our brains for the rest of our lives, and we are building on this. So there is a real physiological aspect, because sometimes people say age and sex, these are real physiological phenomena, but education is not. Well, it also has this dimension. And what does it do? Well, the enhancement of cognitive skills, we have evidence that we have less risky behavior if you're more educated. We are expanding our personal planning horizon. Very importantly, we are learning better from past damage. And of course, we also have better access to relevant information. We can improve health and our physical well-being. And last but not least, education also increases income, and that allows us to purchase more of the goods that we think are necessary for our health. So there is a very important, plausible, convincing causal narrative here, how education affects health and fertility. Now, we are going in the book in a new field as well. And there was sort of an interesting coincidence that at the time when we were finalizing our projections, also the international global environmental change community started working on a new set of global scenarios. As you may know, there were the scenarios of the IPCC called the stress scenarios, also by a group in the IASA's energy program, and they only had two socioeconomic variables. One was total population size, and the other was total GDP. So population essentially had the function of a scaling parameter for calculating a GDP per capita, energy consumption per capita, and so on. Now this new exercise wanted to do better on the socioeconomic side. As although the title says, that they really have different socioeconomic pathways that matter both for the mitigative capacity and for the adaptive capacity of societies. So in the end, these projections and these scenarios, as you see them published in the book, are identical to the different SSPs, and what we say the human core of the SSPs, meaning the projections of populations by age, sex, and level of education. This is SSP 2, called the middle of the road, or if you want, the medium scenario. We are currently at above 7 billion, 7.2, 7.3 billion estimated. And currently we have a little more uneducated adults in the world than people with tertiary education. And this is going to change soon. In 10 years, we already have more people with tertiary education than without any education. And this is partly already embedded in the fact that in almost every country, the young are better educated than the old, and demographic metabolism will increase the average education of the population. We are expecting a peak somewhere around 9.4 billion between 2065-2070, followed by a small decline to around 9 billion. Now, SSP1 is the most rapid development. It is called the sustainable development scenario. Here you have very rapid expansion, not quite as rapid as in Singapore, but almost. And you see much faster growth of the more highly educated population. The world population would be peaking earlier, maybe in 2055. And actually by the end of the century could fall to below 7 billion, similar to the beginning of the century. So that is sort of a most rapid socioeconomic development scenario. But then there is a scenario of stagnation, SSP3. Where you see the total population increasing to more than 12 billion, and you see not much change in the educational distribution of the world. You see actually an increase in the uneducated population and stagnation in the other proportions. So this is just a spectrum of some of these SSP scenarios and how different human development trajectories look. But then the SSP scenarios, of course, have many other dimensions that we are not covering here in the population projections. But I should say, the economic growth projections that I included, they are now fully consistent with our human capital projections. Because you may know that in 2008, we had an article in Science that was called The Demography of Human Capital Formation and Economic Growth, where we showed clearly how the improvements of education in different age groups contribute directly to economic growth. And there we also made the point that it requires nearly universal secondary education in addition to primary education to bring countries out of poverty. And by the way, I'm very happy to see that now the draft of the new sustainable development goals that are following the Millennium Development Goals, and you know the Millennium Development Goals only had universal primary education. Now the sustainable development goals are likely, it looks from today, that they have universal primary and secondary education as a goal. Okay, this also has impacts on the age structure, and in the book we also introduced some innovative measurements of age, which is not just time since birth, but also what proportion of the population has on average 15 or less years to live, some redefinitions of what is old. And here you clearly see under different scenarios, it's both the shape of the pyramid as well as the educational composition that greatly varies with the SSPs. In the book itself, we have a concluding chapter, it's called Epilogue, With Education, the Future Looks Different. We show some of the ways how it does indeed look different, but we are not going into policy. There has been now recently in the September issue of Population and Development Review, another paper called Toward a 21st Century Population Policy Paradigm, or rationale, I call it there, and you find a policy brief that summarizes some of these points. So the main point is that national human resource management for sustainable development, that could be the main paradigm, the main rationale for population policies in the 21st century. Just going beyond the numbers and, if you want, add the quality dimension. And this focus on universal primary and secondary education and basic health, these are the dimensions there. And they would be valid for all countries in the world, not just developing countries, but for shrinking, aging, rich countries as well. It would be fully consistent with human rights. There would be no clash of interests there. And as I said before, it is at the very heart of the MDGs and the likely SDGs. And in particular, we point as a specific focus on female education. Why? Well, it empowers women within the family and within society to exercise their reproductive rights. I mean, there's so much evidence that also women who are classified to have an unmet need for contraception, a big reason for not using contraception is that their husbands or their extended family has objections. Well, if the woman is empowered through more education, she can more easily overcome these obstacles. And then, as I've showed, female education is a key to moderating rapid population growth in high fertility contexts. It can contribute to economic growth, as I had outlined before. And also, it increases female labor force participation and productivity. And this is very valid for some of the aging European countries. And last not least, and we don't have the time to discuss it now, but we have a series of studies to show how it can contribute to the quality of institutions, to democracy, and even to the adaptive capacity to environmental change.